Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I am Dr. Samina Rahman, sex med gynecologist, menopause expert in downtown Chicago. Today I'm doing a solo podcast because I wanted to talk to you guys about something that I've discussed on this podcast before. When I had Dr. Alexandra Soa on, we talked about her book, The Ozempic Revolution. So you guys can take a look at that. But as a sex med gynecologist, I have a particular interest in what happens to patients who go on GLP medications and what it does to their sex life, which really wasn't studied and is now being looked at and studied in more detail. And so that's what I want to talk about today. You hear about Ozempic face, you hear about Ozempic vulva, you hear about everything related to Ozempic. Well, what about Ozempic sex? Let's get at it. All right. So hi again, once again, everyone. This is Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. So, you know, I've been actually studying these GLP-1 medications since about 2018. And we all know that they're not that new, right? We know that the first GLP was approved called Byetta, and that was in 2005. So when people say that these medications are new and we don't know what they do, it's absolutely incorrect. We know these medications are 20 years old. They just keep coming back in different types. And the oral medications that predated Ozempic, which came out in 2017, you know, just were never as efficacious, right? But in 2017, Ozempic was launched, which is semaglutide. And I had a special interest in understanding these medications for a couple different reasons. Number one, I treat midlife women. I treat women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. And I treat a lot of women who are at high risk for diabetes and heart disease. So I have a lot of South Asians in my population. And I have a lot of family members who are diabetic. And so once one of them started going on this medication, I was like, I need to do a deep dive into this. Such that I've taken enough coursework that I should sit for my obesity boards. And I was going to do it last year. And then my mother died in October and I just couldn't study for it or do it. I couldn't wrap my head around it at the time. And so I just didn't sit for it yet. So I will take some more coursework because now my coursework is expired because I took my coursework in 2023. So by the time I sit for my obesity boards in 2026, it will be expired. So I'm going to have to take some new coursework, which is fine because I love taking courses and going to conferences. You guys know I like to keep my finger on the pulse of everything. So anyway, stay tuned because hopefully in a year I can get my obesity board certification. But I want to really talk about what nobody's talking about when it comes to GLP-1s and Ozempic. And it's really about desire and sexual function. This is what we're really not talking about. Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, Zepbound, Tirzepatide. You know, these medications have exploded. They have been life transformative to so many of my patients. I remember the first time in 2018 when I had my patient who maybe it was closer to 2019 when I put my first PCOS patient on this medication who I had been significantly, just had maxed out her metformin, had done everything in her power to control her diet, exercise, protein intake, the works. And we talked about it, you know, it's not FDA approved for PCOS, but just like birth control pills are not FDA approved for painful periods or heavy periods, we can give them for that reason, but it just might not get covered. Back in 2019, actually, before it became kind of the Ozempic craze started, and this was probably either late 2018 or early 2019. Patients, if they failed metformin and they had PCOS, many of their prescriptions were covered. So I had many patients who were getting Ozempic for $20 a month. And it was very upsetting as more and more people started utilizing this medication for weight loss purposes. And then, you know, Wegovy, all these other medications came forward. And as the supply and demand issue came up and more people who could afford it were willing to pay out of pocket, this is when the whole compounding industry started with semaglutide and tirzepatide. And now there's some big bans against using compounding medications. A compounding pharmacy cannot sell it as a pure semaglutide or tirzepatide. It has to kind of be, for lack of a better term, laced with something else, like, you know, B12 or something else that people will find. Anyway, my point is, this patient, my first patient I ever put on this medication for weight loss and PCOS, made transformative changes. It was really significant and pretty impressive. And at the time, I never really thought about what GLPs do to your brain. People often ask me what I think about peptides and longevity, because longevity has become sort of like the buzzword, right? So peptides are a big thing within that. And so people always ask, well, what do you think about the peptides? And my answer is always, I really like one peptide, and that's the glucagon-like peptide 1, which is what GLP stands for, right? GLP-1 is glucagon-like peptide 1, and it's naturally occurring peptide that's released after you eat. It makes your pancreas want to make more insulin and decrease the glucagon production, which is essentially what raises blood sugar. Insulin is what lowers your blood sugar. And so it works by, so it's, again, it's a naturally occurring peptide. And so when GLP-1s came out, I think it was like, I don't know, first derived from like a lizard or something, from what I remember. They have absolutely transformed how we approach metabolic disease, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. We don't quite have a great understanding of how it works with your sexual function, although many of us have done some studies on this now, so we have some understanding. So that's kind of what a GLP-1 is, that when it's naturally occurring, right? They work on your gut, they work on your brain. But really, these medications, which are GLP-1 receptor agonists, so they act on the GLP-1 receptor, have absolutely transformed how we treat metabolic disease, obesity, cardiovascular disease, the works. But really, to understand what they do to sexual function, we need to get an understanding of what happens to our brain, because our brain has GLP-1 receptors. And so what happens to our brain when we use these medications? Because people will often say, you know, I have so many examples. I remember the first time I met one of my patients who I placed on the GLP-1 receptor agonist, which was Wegovy at the time. She is somebody that would come in with like the most glamorous outfits, shopped like crazy, all the things. And she came in to me one day upset because she's like, I don't feel like shopping anymore. And shopping was my thing. Shopping was the thing I did to make myself feel better. And I was like, oh, yes, because you possibly were getting a reward from shopping, right? It was retail therapy was helping you, and now retail therapy is not helping you. And so that's really important to understand, right? Because there are patients out there who start GLP-1 receptor agonists, and they all of a sudden don't want to go to girls' night out anymore because they don't feel like drinking. They're total foodies, and they can't stand going out to dinner anymore, or they feel sick trying to eat. They don't get that same pleasure from food. They don't get that same pleasure from, you know, drinking with their friends, or their drive to eat and drink goes down. You know, there's so much that happens. I have patients that pivot. You know, they start activating a new part of their brain because they're not consumed with food cravings and all these things. So some people start new hobbies and start new careers even, you know, like between midlife hormone changes and midlife weight gain, going on these medications can be life transformative, but they can also really change how you experience pleasure, right? And that's because GLP-1. Quick reality check. If you're listening to this and thinking, why does no one ever talk to me like this in my doctor's office? That's because most doctors aren't trained to, nor do they have the infrastructure for it. That's why I started the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, my new concierge practice where sexual wellness, hormone health, and gynecology actually come together like they're supposed to. No 10-minute visits, no gaslighting, no have a glass of wine, relax. Just evidence-based, shame-free care for women who are done settling for bad sex, brain fog, hot flashes, or feeling invisible. I'm proud to be part of the Ms. Medicine Network, which means your care is rooted in science, not stigma. Find us at www.thegsmcollective.com and book the kind of appointment you wish you had had years ago. Your body called. It wants its power back. Let's go. Receptor agonists don't just work in the gut and pancreas, like I said. They work centrally in the brain, in the reward pathway, in the motivation pathway, in our pleasure pathways. And so, you know, that dopaminergic reward pathway can be affected, and it can be really good for some patients, and it can be really not good for some patients. So it's something I always warn my patients about. I ask them if they're foodies. I ask them if they really like, you know, have patients that own wineries. They're like, wait, but I own a winery and you're telling me, and I'm like, well, you know, your relationship with alcohol will change for the most part. So they're really actually showing actually a lot of promise and substantial promise for treating substance use disorders, actually, because it's precisely how they modulate the reward circuits and the dopaminergic signaling. In fact, there was a large Swedish registry study of over 227,000 individuals who had an alcohol use disorder, and they took semaglutide and liraglutide, and these two medications were associated with a significantly lower risk of alcohol-related hospitalizations compared to periods of non-use, and the effects that were actually stronger than some of the medications that are currently approved to treat alcohol use disorder. So that's pretty good. So, you know, stay tuned. Maybe a new indication coming our way. You know, mechanistically, if you think about it, GLP-1 receptor agonists reduce drug and alcohol intake when patients take it, right? Like I just said, some people will stop wanting to have alcohol. Some people stop wanting to use drugs because it blunts that whole dopamine release in reward pathways and decreases relapse behavior associated with multiple substances, alcohol, nicotine, stimulants, opioids. What's really interesting to me is they also reduce neuroinflammation because these medications are largely anti-inflammatory. They're huge. I mean, that's why PCOS patients do well with it because it's a pro-inflammatory condition. That's why a lot of endometriosis patients do well with it because it's a pro-inflammatory condition. You know, sometimes, strangely, like I'll place a patient that I know has endometriosis on it for weight loss purposes or because they are, you know, pre-diabetic with PCOS as well. And they tell me like, you know, some of my pain is gone. Some of my pain is reduced. And so it's very interesting because these are anti-inflammatory drugs. So people, I remember talking to my colleague and friend, Dr. Tanya Dempsey, who treats so much mast cell activation syndrome, really talking about how some of these patients show improvement in their symptoms. So the anti-inflammatory effect is pretty significant. And they also reduce neural inflammation. They can reprogram your microglia toward anti-inflammatory states. They actually can decrease microglia and astrocytes and support neuronal survival. I mean, just think about that for a minute. And actually, so there are some preclinical models that show that GLP-1 agonists can actually reduce amyloid beta and tau pathology in Alzheimer's disease models and preserve dopaminergic neurons in Parkinson's disease models. And these are just, you know, usually rat studies or, you know, this is not by any means telling you that we can use these to prevent any of these conditions, but they may have a key role in neurodegeneration. So that is something that is being looked at as well. And GLP receptors are really expressed in key brain regions that involve cognition, emotion, motivation, motor control, including the hippocampus, the frontal cortex, and the substantia nigra. So when we talk about these medications reducing food noise, craving, compulsive behavior, what we really are saying is that they change how the body experiences reward. And the brain does not compartmentalize pleasure, right? So when we talk about food, alcohol, substances, retail, shopping, motivation, and sex, these are all overlapping reward pathways. So today, I actually want to talk about the one aspect of reward that people sometimes forget to talk about or are too ashamed to talk about, and that is sex. I want to talk about what GLP medications do incredibly well, and what we assumed that they would do for sexual function, but what the emerging data and science is actually showing us, and why two seemingly opposite experiences, feeling better in your body while feeling different about sex, can be both true at the same time. Because, you know, you think that if someone's body image was preventing their desire, that if they improved their body image, their desire would improve. And that does not always pan out. And that's why it's really complicated. So remember, let's talk about what GLP receptor agonists really do. Again, they originally developed to treat type 2 diabetes. Remember, they work by increasing insulin secretion, they suppress glucagon, they slow gastric emptying, and they improve your glycemic control, right? And what they do in the brain is everything, right? Remember, we say these receptors exist in the central nervous system. They don't just reduce hunger, they reduce food noise, they reduce food cravings, and they reduce compulsive reward-seeking behavior. So that's why when we talk about the brain not compartmentalizing pleasure, this runs throughout all reward pathways. So when we talk about, you know, what we would expect, right? We would expect, okay, yeah, we talked about the body image thing, right? Someone doesn't feel good about themselves. They have poor body image because, you know, they don't feel good in their body. They lose weight that should improve their body image. Then we think, you know, sexual function should improve. When it comes to better metabolic health, right? We always talk about, like, you know, erectile dysfunction or sexual dysfunction can be the first sign of metabolic disease. It can be the first sign of diabetes. It can be the first sign of hypertension and flow. So if we're improving vascular flow because we're improving metabolic health, wouldn't this improve sexual function? And if we're improving our mood overall, do you think that this would, because libido is a mood, would it improve intimacy? And so the thought process was always that this medication would improve sexual function. And for some people, it absolutely does. But remember, sexual function is very complicated. It's bio, it's cycle, it's social. And so for some people, sexual desire is improved because their body image improves and they feel better about themselves and their blood flow is better. But sexual desire is not just about confidence. It's not just about hormones, and it's not just about anatomy. Sexual desire for so many people is reward-driven behavior. And that's how it becomes a complicated story, just like most things about sex. It's complicated. It's bio, it's psycho, it's social. An article that was just published by my colleague and friend, Dr. Jim Simon, about GLP-1 medications and what the emerging science says. And this review was called Clinical Review of How Glucagon-like Peptide 1 Agonist Obesity Medications Decrease to Sexual Desire and a Biopsychosocial Model for Why We Don't See It. So that's a very important article that was just come out, actually. You know, the author suggests that GLP-1 medications do reduce sexual desire because through the serotonergic pathways, right? Particularly by activating that serotonergic receptor, which the 5-HT2C, which is also involved in appetite suppression. There was an article that was recently published called, and it's titled Clinical Review of How Glucagon-like Peptide 1 Agonist Obesity Medications Decrease Sexual Desire and a Biopsychosocial Model for Why We Don't See It. This article was in Obesity Pillars, and it is by Dr. James Simon. He sent me the article, which is awesome. So the authors of this study suggest that when these GLP medications are used, they actually can reduce sexual desire through serotonergic pathways, particularly because they can activate the 5-HT2C receptor, which is also involved in appetite suppression. So this is really important, right? Because we already know that increased serotonin and serotonergic tone, like SSRIs, think about those, right? They blunt libido, orgasm, and spontaneous sexual thoughts. Let's think back to some of our libido podcasts, right? I always talk about the sexual tipping point. Let's talk about some of the libido episodes that we've done, okay? I talk about the brain as your biggest sexual organ, right? We talk about this all the time. And so renowned sex med expert, Dr. Michael Perelman, came up with this idea of the sexual tipping point as you know, what is it going to, what's going to put you into an excitatory mode or an inhibitory mode, right? And so what have we talked about? We talk about serotonin as a neurotransmitter that, and I call this the let's go versus ah, hell no mode, right? So what's on in our, when it comes to our brain, what's in the let's go side, right? The let's go side is dopamine. It's norepinephrine. It's oxytocin. It's testosterone. It's these hormones and these neurotransmitters that provide the circuits for our brain to get us excited about sex, to get us feeling into that arousal and orgasm zone. And then you have the hell no, man, I'm not doing it today. That's when we have like too much serotonin, too much prolactin, you know, maybe opioids, other things that can tip us the other way. So, because again, our brain is our biggest sexual organ. So the theory is with these GLP-1s, because of its serotonergic effect, it can cause sexual dysfunction for some people, just like SSRIs can. The theory is really that can dampen the hedonic reward system, right? But this includes desire in a subset of patients, and it can affect and really be camouflaged by competing improvements of weight loss, confidence, vascular health, right? So it's, again, blunting that reward pathway. So your desire might go down because of that, you know, serotonergic surge or whatever, and that dopamine decrease, which competes against what we feel like is the natural tendency for someone if they lose weight, if they feel more confident, or if they improve their vascular health, right? What's going to happen? We expect their sexual function to improve, but it doesn't always do that. So when we think about it, biologically, you know, GLP-1 medications are doing a lot of things at the same time. They decrease desire by that central serotonergic modulation. They can cause side effects like nausea and fatigue. Remember, because a lot of people, when they start these medications, they don't have a drive to even go exercise, right? They just feel kind of like fatigued and nauseated. When we feel nauseated, when we feel like vomiting. And these are early side effects. Most people's side effects will go away over time. Then you don't feel like having sex. But it also can increase your sex hormone binding globulin. And we talk about that a lot on this podcast, the SHBG, which can lower your free testosterone, which can then have, again, that tipping point effect where it decreases your reward, your motivation to have sex. But on the flip side, again, weight loss increases total testosterone. It improves endothelial function because it can improve genital blood flow. Better glycemic control can improve arousal physiology, right? Because it can improve, then you know, people, when they get diabetic neuropathy and they get issues with their nerve endings, they don't have, you know, the same type of orgasm. They don't have the same type of arousal. But if we're getting better glycemic control and we're not leading toward that neuropathic changes, then we can have a better arousal physiology. So the body may be more responsive, but the drive can be a little quieter. So really, that's not really dysfunction. It's neurobiology, right? So what do we do about it? So that's why this proposal by Dr. Simon is that we should look at it through that biopsychosocial lens. We know we should be doing that anyway, a sexual function. So, you know, the psychological layer to it is that many patients will say, you know, I feel better in my body. I feel more confident naked. I don't hate myself in the mirror anymore. But at the same time, they're saying, I don't think about sex at all. I could take it or leave it. I don't feel this internal drive to do it. And then if you add in sort of the stress of how much GLP-1s used to cost in relationship renegotiation, right? Like, because there's might be a desire mismatch. Again, just like you might not want to go drink with your buddies, or, you know, you might not want to go to that great restaurant, the foodie place. The same thing, you might not want to be hanging out with your significant other. You might feel different in your own identity. And again, the fatigue is a factor for so many people. So I think those are all very important things to remember when we're addressing these patients, because it is biopsychosocial. And that's kind of the psychology of it, right? When we talk about the cost stress, actually, I want to just address that for a moment, because right now, because the supply and demand issue is not as significant, and because they're trying to decrease the number of compounding medications used, you can actually get Wegovy is your first time getting it, which is semaglutide for $199 for the first 2 months if your insurance doesn't cover it, right? So if you don't meet the qualifications or if your insurance opts out of these class of medications, which many people do, then, or many companies have opted out of these medications. So it's made a little bit more difficult for people to acquire these medications. So right now you can get Wegovy and Ozempic, if you're not FDA approved for it, for $199 for the first 2 months and then $399 afterwards, which is pretty remarkable considering that just last year or a year and a half ago, it was $599, then it was $499. And prior to that, even it was, you know, $1,100 or something when your insurance didn't cover it. Now, if your insurance covers it, if you're a diabetic for Ozempic, or if you have a BMI greater than 30, or if you have a BMI greater than 27 and you have some comorbid conditions such as hypertension, such as high cholesterol or other metabolic issues, then your insurance might cover it and you can get it for like $20 or even totally covered. So again, this idea that sexual function would improve is, you know, in fact, theoretical, but it also is talking about sex as if it was like just bio or just psycho or just social, but it's a combination of all of them. So we got to look at all the aspects and we have to look at the patient in front of you and really decide what's happening with them and what's happening with their relationships. Are their relationships changing, right? Is stuff happening from that perspective? And that's why you get sex therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy involved as well. Tirzepatide, which is similar to semaglutide, but it is a dual GIP/GLP-1 receptor agonist. And so it could be that people have, you know, stronger effects on their appetite suppression and reward signaling, but it also, for some patients, has less of the GI side effects. And so there have been some case studies of another thing that I wanted to talk about. And it's with tirzepatide, has been some case studies with that. And there's been some case studies with semaglutide as well. And I've done this, I've actually written up a case about this as well, because I talk about this on many podcasts, persistent genital arousal disorder, right? And that is a rare condition where you feel this persistent either feeling of arousal that's not in the context of sexual thought. And the way we work up persistent genital arousal disorder, you guys can check out some of the podcasts that I've done on this, is really looking at the five regions that are involved, right? Because this is really a nerve-related issue, right? It's abnormal sensation in the genital pelvic region, or it's a form of a genital pelvic dysesthesia. And so we look at region one, which is your end organ, that's your clitoris, that's your vulva, that's your vestibule, that's the skin of the vulva as well. We look at, and then the end nerves, like the dorsal nerve of the clitoris. We look at region two, which is the pelvis. So we look at whether or not the pelvic floor is always involved. So you should always get pelvic floor PT for this. We look at whether or not the pudendal nerve or the peripheral nerves that feed into the pelvis are injured or otherwise compromised. We look at the venous flow to the pelvis. So do you have any form of venous insufficiency? So that's region two, which means that you might need a stent or something in the pelvis to improve the blood flow. That was previously known as, these are pelvic venous disorders, and that's region two. And then region three is, three and four is your cauda equina, which are those nerve roots, and your lumbar sacral spine. And so we look at the nerve origins to what's feeding the genitals, right? Is there a Tarlov cyst that's compressing the nerve roots in the sacrum, which feed into the pudendal nerve, which eventually feeds your clitoris and your vulva and your genitalia? Is it a tear in the lumbar sacral annulus of the disc, or a herniated disc, that's causing nerve root inflammation, which has led to all these things? And this is why interventional pain, spine, and orthopedics and neurosurgery are involved in the care of persistent genital arousal disorder. And then there's region five, right? That's your brain. And that's the dopamine, that's the serotonin, that's the pathways that start the signal that says that you're going to be persistently aroused. That's the region that tells us that this might be a form of OCD. This is similar to OCD. This is similar to anxiety. So region five is usually eventually involved as well. So this unwanted, intrusive, persistent genital arousal without sexual interest or relief is associated with dopaminergic shifts, with serotonergic changes, with peripheral nerve sensitization, with central reward dysregulation. And so because this happens, any medicine that modulates serotonin, dopamine, and reward pathways has the plausibility to influence PGAD symptoms. So what that means is if your reward pathway is getting blunted, right, is it possible that this signal that's making this arousal happen is getting blunted? And what I've seen in my clinical practice is a number of patients who that I think either has centrally become involved. Like I had a patient who was perimenopausal, who experienced weight gain. We normalized her hormone, or we tried to fix some of the hormones ups and downs that caused some of the anxiety that fed the PGAD. She had pelvic floor PT. We looked at the genital urinary syndrome, menopause as contributing. But then what helped her again the most was at the end of the day, which kind of like completely stopped her persistent genital arousal, was starting on semaglutide because it calmed down that dopaminergic response. And so are there patients that can benefit from this with PGAD? I certainly think so, and I've certainly seen it. So I think that's something to always keep in mind is what's happening with your brain when you start these medications, right? Because sexual health is not a luxury outcome. It's really a quality of life outcome. When we prescribe medications that affect reward, that affect appetite, that affect mood and pleasure, we really have the responsibility to ask about sex, and we haven't been doing it. Not because everyone should be having sex or more sex. And we're not trying to create like people that are, hypersexual. We really want people to connect with the people they want to connect with, to feel like themselves again, if that is something that's distressing them. Because patients deserve to understand the changes in their bodies. And patients deserve that type of consent, right? So if you're a clinician who prescribes these medications, it's really worth talking to patients about what brings you pleasure, because that can change. That will absolutely have the possibility of changing. If chocolate brings you pleasure, you may never want chocolate again. You never know how your brain is going to be impacted. It's not across the board. I have a couple of patients who are true foodies, and they still enjoy going to restaurants. They just eat very little when they're there. Because a patient can love their weight loss, but still be confused or distressed because of changes in desire. And they can have improved arousal, but still feel emotionally disconnected from sex. They can also feel less obsessed with food, but also feel less motivated toward intimacy. And all these experiences are totally valid. But this is how I counsel my patients. And this is how informed consent should actually look like. I talk to my patients. I say, you know what? You have GLP receptors, not only in your gut, but in your brain. So when we influence this, we're influencing the inflammation in your brain potentially, and we're influencing these reward pathways. And so some people will notice that they're not going to want to have that girls' night out with their friends anymore because they don't want to drink alcohol. They might stop smoking, which is going to be great for them. They may decide that the runs that give them that high are just, they're not motivated for it. Or they may stop wanting to go out to eat with their significant other, and it can cause problems in their relationships. So I always warn them about this. And I always tell them that some people say they have changes in sexual desire on GLPs. That can mean more, less, or just feels different. And when it becomes distressing, we can talk about it. We can alter things. We can work on the biopsychosocial element. Because sexual desire doesn't exist in isolation, and neither should our counseling about GLP-1 medications. We really do need more longitudinal sexual function data, more menopause-specific analysis, more testosterone and SHBG correlations, more outcomes that are based on sexual function and distress. But because so many of our adults are using it, sexual health cannot be an afterthought. We have to be thinking about this. GLP-1 medications are one of the most powerful tools we have in metabolic medicine. But with great power comes great responsibility. And we should be responsible enough to have these discussions about what brings patients pleasure, because this can absolutely change. If a medication changes how the brain is experiencing hunger, reward, and any type of pleasure, it can change how they experience sex. And patients deserve to know that. And this isn't about fear. This is really about honesty and autonomy. And sexual health is health It is real medicine, and we need to consider it in everything that we do. Anyway, I hope you guys learned a little something. I know I certainly do when I take deep dives into some of these topics. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. I'll see you next week. Take care. Bye.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.